When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times podcast brought to you by HT Smartcast.
Hi, this is Manjula Narayan, National Books Editor, Hindustan Times, and this is the Books and Authors podcast. It's a weekly podcast where I speak to authors who've got a new book out. Hi, so today we have with us Reema Desai Gehi, who's written The Catalyst, Rudolf von Leyden, and India's Artistic Awakening. Hello. Hi, Reema.
Hi. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
You know, Reema, it's a great book. And I felt that, like, you've done a lot of justice to your subject, you know, and you've recreated the whole, a whole era, which was kind of missing. I mean, you know, this we needed a book like this to bring these people alive. So, you know, you've said that you in your book, you said you've written how you came to do the book. But for the listeners, you know, who haven't read it yet, let's start with that.
Like how the idea came about?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so in 2016, I was working with Mumbai Mirror. It was a widely popular newspaper affiliated with the Times Group. And Syed Haider Raza had passed away, the master modernist.
Yes.
And he was the founding member of the Bombay Progressive Artists Group. And so while Dr. Saryu Doshi, the following day, we had published a wonderful obituary written by her, we as a Bombay paper, the editor of Mirror then, Meenal, and I thought that it would be nice to pay a larger tribute to Raza's legacy. Because if you look at Raza's story, he is the quintessential Bombay success story. This man, yes, who's a forest ranger's son, he comes to Bombay, becomes an artist of much repute, gets a scholarship, takes off to France. And of course, Raza became Raza, but he was also the founding member of the Bombay Progressive Artist Group, which was arguably the most important art movement in the country.
Yes.
And, you know, the obvious sort of a suggestion was that we have Krishan Khanna write a larger essay on the making of the progressives and Raza's role. Krishan Khanna obliged for an interview. And so I took off to Delhi to meet with him. Mm-hmm. And of course, Krishan Khanna, being Krishan Khanna, was very, very generous with his time and tales. And he regaled me with many, many anecdotes, stories of the formation of the progressive group, stories of Hussein, Raza, Ara. And towards the end of the interview, actually, when I was waiting for my taxi after our interview, was completed, he very suddenly asked me, what is Times of India doing with the writings of Rudy von Leyden? And I looked at him quizzically and I sort of drew a blank. And I remembered he had mentioned him in some capacity in our interview, but I wasn't entirely sure why he's asking me. And I said, probably nothing. And then he said, well, you're sitting there. Why don't you do something about it? So that kind of piqued my curiosity. And at that time, the Times had a wonderful archives room on the second floor in their Bombay office. And so one fine day, in between manic newsroom moments, I just took off to the archive room. And I, fortunately, they had digitized everything of the Times at the Times. And I just curiously went on the search engine and typed Leyden, R.V. Leyden, Rudolf von Leyden, Rudy von Leyden. And then I realized I have this plethora of art history that no one knows about, that exists in the news publications archives. Mm. And that kind of set the wheels in motion, and, you know, the journey of the book began. And While I thought the initial idea would be to compile his writings, one needed to know who this man was. So I called up Krishan Khanna again, from whom this idea came from, and I told him, it's piqued my it, your conversation piqued my curiosity, and I found this archive of these writings of Rudi von Leiden. And but one needs to give context to everything, and who was Rudi von Leiden? And he said something that piqued my curiosity further. He said he was the kingpin of art, and I said that's a very loaded label to put on somebody. And then this search of this who this kingpin of art began, and a mere Google search led me to his nephew James von Leiden, who lives in the UK, and he's an author of crime fiction books set in Morocco. And I reached to him on LinkedIn, actually reached out to him on LinkedIn actually, and I asked him, how many people have the surname von Leiden? And I asked him, are you by any chance related to Rudi von Leiden, Rudolf von Leiden? And a little shy of a month later, he responded saying, well, I'm indeed his nephew. And then, he
Why
spat
did it
with me.
take him 1 month? I wondered when I read it
Maybe he must have not checked his message. Maybe he
also.
must be having, these characters reaching out to him to know what collection he has. But I think he sort of spoke to me a couple of times before he told me he was his legal heir and has inherited his estate, which means he's also inherited all the diary notes, letters, photographs, and to European families, to their credit, they are so good with archiving personal histories that he told me, if you're really serious about this, I think you should apply for a grant and come to the UK, and you're welcome to stay at my studio. Just built outside of his house, and rummaged through everything, and that's precisely what I did. And then over the course of while I was planning my trip to James's archive attic, he introduced me to his cousin Flora, who's based in Germany, who in turn introduced me to that other cousin who was based also in Germany in Bonn, and his third partner who was based in Berlin. And I realized there is this collector, Laura Chaudhry, who is in Vienna, and there's somebody in Paris who's researched about Rudi's Ganjifa cards. So on that trip, which was in 2018, I ended up having eight meetings in Europe and the UK. So and then when I came back, I realized, well, this is a book.
Yeah, that's
When
a
I went
lot.
took off, I didn't know what it was. I thought it's going to be a research. I'm going to do something about it. But let's see what comes out of this whole exercise.
So it just grew one step at a time, basically.
Yes, it did. It did.
But it's so sad that he Rudi von Leiden. I mean, I didn't know how his name was pronounced before you, mentioned it. But it's so sad that he gave away his art because James would have inherited all that. And those
I
are the
know.
masters, right? And
I
when
know, I know. People collected art to support these artists who came from very humble backgrounds. But they also, it was, I don't know, or I don't think they realized that they'd become the masters that they are considered today. It was all for the love of art, by the love of art, and it just was something that they just felt was the right thing to do. For instance, what do I do with this collection of paintings that belongs to Bombay artists? Well, the logical thing what to do is donate it to the museum. Realize that, okay, someday, 5 decades from now, it's going to become like a blue chip investment.
Yeah, but not just that, because he was forced, kind of, because his wife didn't like it, right? I
Most
felt
of them
sad
like it.
about that.
I know. I mean, yeah.
So that's like it's like a what if he'd kept it,
It's also the question of aesthetics, right? Like the reason she didn't want, from what I gathered, from what I understood, talking to various people who knew her, especially Krishan Khanna, it was a question of aesthetics. It didn't match hers. right?
Yeah.
So what would these works do in an apartment in Paris or in a house in
Yes.
Paris, right? So I think it was more of a practical decision. Let's just leave this behind and give it to the museum if they are interested in.
Okay.
And I think these kind of stories are built in hindsight, right? Like, yes, there
Yeah.
was this movement in art, and yes, there was these artists became who they became. All the narrative building is always done in hindsight. I
Yes.
don't think it started off they were trying to change the world or change the art movement. It just so happened that they were very, I mean, from what I gather, they were all quite idealistic. They had this idea of, this narrative building about new India and what is it that we want to create. And together they just wanted to do good work, from what I gather, and not really announce themselves as a group or, we're a movement and we're going to change things around. And
Also, they were also a bunch of young guys who hung out together, right?
correct,
You
correct.
know, which brings me to this thing about how there are just no women except for Banu Attaya. You
Right.
know, there are no women, and Banu Attaya, went on to do great things in another field entirely. She
Right.
gave this up. Though even in a recent book of hers, there's a mention about her arty, about her being part of this exhibition. I remember, you know, reading about it, and then
But I
she
guess,
broke off into
but I guess
costumes.
it was also a function of the times, right?
Yes.
I mean, where like
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. You know, when I read this, I thought that, oh, things have changed so much. You would never think of a big exhibition of even young artists now without having a lot of female, artists, lots of women, lots of, a lot of diversity in terms of sexuality and not just gender.
True, 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 true.
So when I was reading your book, I was just also thinking, wow, the art scene has changed so much, the world has changed
It
so much. You
has evolved a bit, yeah.
know? Yeah. So, you know, when you were, you've done a lot of this research and you've put in so much work into this book. But what was the most difficult part? Like, were they, you know, was there a stumbling block that you just had to kind of overcome?
I think it was, I guess, my background in, writing for a mainstream paper, that for me, this was not a, in my mind from the beginning when I learned, I realized he was such a Renaissance mind, right? That this can't strictly be an art book, right? An art book for the art community. In my mind, it was always a larger social history book.
Yes.
Where,
Yes.
and for me, the initial challenge was, okay, I didn't exist at that period, right? How do I know what Bombay was like at that time? So I met quite a few people who grew up in Bombay of that time, who were around working. And to capture the sight and sound of Bombay of that time was the initial challenge. Again, I also didn't want to write it strictly like an art book is expected to be written. Or in my mind, I think that, oh, this is how, in order to kind of fit into these labels of art writing and all of that, one has to write the book in a certain way. But something that I kept thinking to myself, it would be a big disservice to Rudy if I wrote it in a highfalutin manner, because his writings were not that. What drew
Yes.
me to his writings, what started this journey, were his writings. And his writings were written in simple, coherent English, bereft of any jargon. And to me, that
Yes.
was refreshing, right? But then I also argued, you play this devil's advocate when you're writing, that maybe because English was not his first language, right? And
Think?
which is why he just stayed objective. He was German, right? So
Yes.
maybe English was not his first language. But then I was like, you know what? I think if I'm approaching this book as a social history book, where art plays a big role, and I'm writing a biography of a man who was beyond just an art critic. I'm just going to write it in an accessible fashion where not just contextualize it, but even break down the language to a certain degree, you know.
Okay. And what I found, in this picture that you've drawn of him, what I found you've done really successfully is bring out his intrinsic goodness. I mean, like, how many people kind of invite others into their homes? How many people, even if they can afford it, will bankroll some poor starving artist? There are more stories of people taking advantage of these artists than of, helping them out like this. So I found that particular thing really lovely. So let's talk
Thank
about
you.
that aspect of his character also, It's kind of
You
rare.
know, it's something. Yeah, it is. It is. And I kind of like, sometimes when you're writing and you're like, okay, am I praising this person a little too much? Right? am I going into that trap of writing all good things about him? And so
Yes.
surely there has to be some, we are all a function of light and dark, right?
Yes.
But I don't think I met anybody who didn't have anything good. I mean, who didn't believe that he was a kind, a generous, like Katie Sunawala's secretary at Voltas. She remembers him as a big man with a big voice and a big heart. And
Yeah, I love that little bit where her son goes and he shakes her son's hand and he turns around and says, "Ye giant che," and then she tells him he's a gentle giant. That's very sweet. Really nice.
And it is also these moments where people have candidly shared whether Ara, right, he was a car washer, and whether he was moved by his art or whether he was moved by his circumstances. One thing he was quite certain for Ara was that he didn't want him to go back washing cars and live a dignified life and a life of that of a painter, you know. And even in his Ara's work, he doesn't say that he's trying to, create a new language in art or anything. It is just in his art, there is just this simple, a childhood dream fulfilled of living the life of an artist, and that, and I feel whether it is inviting a Geeth Patel, who was a 25-year-old, fresh out of medical school, writing poetry. And inviting people like Partha Sarthi, Nisim Ezekiel over to his house and having a young Geeth Patel read out poems, that is a lot of encouragement, for young artists, writers, poets. And I don't think he did it with the intention of like, oh, I am doing it. It just came across as a thing to do,
And generally, the family seems quite remarkable. The Fawnie Lydens. They seem like people who kind of went out of their way to do things.
Right. I guess they also came from a certain privilege. And sometimes I feel like there was also this, I wouldn't call it like feeling bad, but it's just one of the things. If you are privileged and if you are in a position to help, to my mind, why wouldn't you?
A lot of people
I
don't.
mean, yeah, but.
But also, the thing is that they also, I mean, because of their Jewish sort of
Is
ancestry.
also perhaps these circumstances where they were pushed out, especially the parents were pushed out of their homes, uprooting and rebuilding a life in another city, which you call home eventually. I think there is a lot of while you take a lot, you also end up giving a lot of, of yourself, of I guess it was also a different era, where people we were genuinely invested in the idea of nation building, in the idea of sort of growing together. And so that comes across very that came across in my research quite apparently.
And I like how I mean, you brought that out about how Krishan Khanna and and Fawn Lydon were both refugees, and so they kind of forged a great friendship based on that. And that's a great point, like, partition
I
here.
thought that I thought like they were, I mean, Krishan Khanna was younger to him by nearly 20 years, 1900. Yeah, nearly 20 years. And what is it that drew, I think sometimes it's like you're bound by common trauma,
Yes.
that makes life so relatable sometimes.
Yes. So that's
Again,
what
this was
happened.
understanding. It's not something like Krishan Khanna said, when you go about forging friendships, you don't think, oh, this is going to evolve in such a manner. It just
Yes.
happens and grows organically. And why you are drawn to certain people, sometimes it's just sometimes what phase of life you're in, why sometimes it is, like I said, bound by common trauma, sometimes it's just bound by common interests. And come to think of it, they did end up sharing a familial bond. Like, in fact, the second wife in her condolence letter says that the Khannas were in every sense his spiritual family.
Yeah. And also, I found this recreation of Bombay and that lovely thing about, the painting of Pali Hill, and then coming back to it later and saying that that's the road that you walk down, as a child, and how Pali Hill and how Bombay has changed. And when you see the photographs and you see the read the book, and you think of, oh, shacks on Juhu Beach, and people going for picnics there, and lovely. It's so evocative of a time when Bombay was a very different place.
It was, and I mean, it was so different. Like, I still live in Bandra, and all around the buildings are going under redevelopment.
Yeah.
And you wonder that will the green space still remain?
I really doubt it, Bombay has changed and the green spaces, yeah, of course. I mean, the picture that emerges from your book is of, like, whatever, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s Bombay. And when, before all the development happened, and now I suppose it's a constant development, right?
It is, and it's a city that keeps rebuilding itself.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
one doesn't know what, like, sort of map one can draw of Bombay. But speaking of how Bombay was, one of the anecdotes that someone shared, it was Adi Jahangir, the grandson of Kawasji Jahangir, the great patron of art. And he had the privilege of meeting Rudi's brother Albrecht von Leyden in Lucerne after he had retired and went to Europe. He shared with Adi that he used to work in Fort, which is about 45 minutes to an hour from Bandra, but preferred to live at Pali Hill in Bandra because when he used to enter Pali Hill, the temperature would drop by 3 degrees.
Wow.
So it was as good as entering some hill station. And
Imagine
to
that.
think that, I think now it's the reverse. The temperature rises by 3 degrees.
That
It was
whole
a very
picture
different
of people
experience.
riding, I and these the von Leydens, going horse riding and hunting, getting the sister a horse so that they could go of her size, and so they could go hunting. I thought, wow, which city is this? It's certainly not in my
No.
lifetime. Yeah, so I found those bits very interesting. Even the bit about the sister and her parents kind of sending her off to Bombay.
Pack her off because she was in love with somebody whom they didn't want her to be with. And then she started this women's hockey team in at the Bombay Gymkhana, and she became the captain of the Ladies 11. In fact, during the official launch of the book that happened at the CSMVS Museum in January, the family was, of course, in town. And Victoria, Rudy's sister's daughter, Flora, had come, and she gave a talk
Oh.
at the Bombay Gymkhana. And they were so excited to have her because here was the daughter of somebody who had started the women's hockey team at the Bombay Gymkhana Ladies 11.
Superb, superb. So at the end of the book, you say that, it's all surrender pitches and, you've made all these connections. But even when I was like reading the book and you've made the connections within the book itself, and I was thinking, wow, pieces seem to have fallen in place. But is it something that one, as a reader, you think that after reading it or what,
Yeah, like you view this project only in hindsight, right? Like while you're going through the motions, you're just like, there are days that are easy, there are days that are quite challenging, and there are days you're like, why have you set yourself up for this? But I think eventually when you honestly, I am too scared to read the book because I'm going to find 1,000 mistakes and then I won't know what to do with myself for the next 6 months. So I sometimes when I have to give the copy to someone, or someone, will give me the book I'm giving these talks at book clubs and they'll give me the book to sign it. I'll quickly read one paragraph. I'm like, okay, it's fine. sign it. But I don't know if I'll go back to reading it cover to cover, because I'm like, what if I notice an error, which is inevitable. And this is something my editor warned me, right? You've done your deed, right? Now you
Just
can
let go.
let go and let the book, the book take its own, the book has its own journey. The research has its own journey.
Yes, because when you've written the book and what you think is out there is very different, maybe, from what the reader gets from it, right? And each reader will
Right,
get a
right.
different thing from it, and it'll spark different, ideas, other
It
books.
was so funny. I gave a talk at this intimate book club 2 weeks ago, and they were full, they were senior women, and three of them actually had met Rudi von Leiden when they were kids. And they were coming up to me and telling me about this anecdote and that anecdote and this what you've mentioned in the book. And for a moment, I just drew a blank and I was like, what are they talking about? Because I realized I haven't seen the book in so long. I haven't read, and then it was just to yesterday I was glancing through it, and I was like, it was all coming back to me, because for a while I was like, I need to keep the book away because I'm so tempted to read it cover to cover, but I'm also quite I don't know if other writers go through this. Maybe it's my first book, yeah, I don't want to beat myself up for it, right?
You should have asked those women, where were you when I was doing my research?
Yeah, like someone was like, I knew him and he stayed in my building and he used to always get me chocolates. And I was like, wow.
Also this whole, this I loved how you brought out this his corporate side as well, because it was the corporate side that allowed him to be the sort of how does one put it? Mentor,
The
no,
patron, the
patron.
patron. I mean, see, while writing, see, as a writer, he was able to mentor them in a different capacity, but it was, I mean, to live, like, let's be practical, to if an artist wants to sustain a life as an artist, they also need to, and I know this is something that people don't talk about in the art world, they also need to sell their work. And who are the people buying it? It is the patrons, and invariably most of the patrons happen to be corporates. And Rudy was able to support them. In fact, Katie Sunawala was a secretary at his at Voltas, shared that his cabin became a quasi gallery of sorts, where people like the artists like Heba, Hussain, Ara used to leave their paintings, and then he used to convince his other director friends to buy their work for 500, 750 rupees. So all these directors went home with an Ara, with a Hussain, with a Heber. And this patronage came from whom? It came from Rudy. And why was Rudy able to play that role? Because he had a corporate job. So I don't think you have to shy away from having that conversation openly also.
No, I'm not saying you should shy away. In fact,
No,
I
no,
think
no, no. I'm saying,
that
I'm talking about, there are people who get really uncomfortable talking about
Why?
it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why would you?
Yeah,
Because
yeah, yeah,
money is at the heart of things. I mean, if you don't
yeah.
look at it, it's kind of stupid, no?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's also money is about, I know we are digressing from art, but it also gives you a certain choice, right? Like it gives you the freedom of choice. So one should not look at it from, from dark lenses. And if
That's
I feel like, which I feel like if there is an artist whose work I really want to support, and Rudy was able to do that, right? There were times where, I don't think he will mind me mentioning this, but I recently met the son of, I'm not sure, I think Vijay Anand, or I don't know, but he mentioned that the Alkazi came over to his father and said, there's this young artist whom I'm representing, and you have to buy his work because the poor man needs the money. And with no intention of supporting Raza, he just managed to buy his work. And today, one of the rarest Razas sits in his house.
Seriously?
But it started because, one needs to create, art exists because of promotion, which Rudy would do with writing, but it also has to exist with patronage, right? So, which is why I got so much access to his corporate life. And see, he was also able to become this, man of a certain standing, this position of power that he enjoyed was because of his corporate job, right? At the heart of it, he was always a promoter, but it was this fine combination of being a promoter and a patron.
And realizing who are the talent as well, right?
Exactly.
Because I'm sure there were many. I mean, we remember these artists, we remember the progressive group, but I'm sure there were many others also who were not that, maybe they were selling greatly at that point, but they're not, we don't remember them anymore for whatever reason, because they were
Correct,
not
correct.
promoted also.
True.
So also, let's talk about the Ganjifa card collection. I found that great, I'm sure like now we think Ganjifa cards, wow. But I'm sure back then, like you mentioned in the book, people were thinking, what Ganjifa card? Kya hai ye? It's like, it's
No,
like
honestly, I
Ganjifa.
still haven't wrapped my mind around how do you play these cards. Try to ex I mean, I still don't, I can't wrap my mind around it, but they are just very beautiful to look at. And it's amazing to think that we had our own playing cards, so to say. It was, forgive my pronunciation, I Gwenyl, the person who did research on, based in France, who did research on Rudy's Ganjifa playing cards, who's at, and I, it was James who put me in touch with him. And it was he who became the sort of person I turned to corroborate information based on whatever little research I did on Ganjifa cards. Because I wasn't sure, is this the right research? But it was that largely that information came from Gwenyl, and he was quite instrumental in piecing that aspect of the book together.
I've seen them, and like now we know a lot about them. But I'm imagining that when Rudy encountered them and decided that, oh my God, these are fantastic. Very few people knew about them, right? And Ali Krishan Khanna himself was like sort of,
This is a
leery about
stupid hobby.
it.
But until he saw him, he heard him speak at the IIC. And I think, and what was interesting to me was that it is not some hobby he picked up post-retirement. It is something he was ambling along Chor Bazaar, which is considered the, an antique furniture market in Mumbai. He found these pack of cards and then got so enamored by it that he decided to write about it at the in the Illustrated Weekly of India. And that's when it kind of like piqued his curiosity about Ganjifa cards, and it stayed along with him. And in a wonderful way, it also became the link for him to come back to India. And yeah, and 19 after he left in 1968, he made his first trip to India since he left in 1977, and he was invited by the Air India to curate a calendar on Ganjifa cards. So each month was dedicated to one aspect, one Ganjifa card actually, and illustrating it. And that I managed to source a copy of that from the Tata Central Archives.
Lovely.
So yeah, that was quite lovely. And this information was also corroborated by his third partner, whom I had met in Berlin, that when she came to, she accompanied him to India in the late 1977. He was welcomed with a lot of typical Indian fanfare, and she realized how important he could be based on this kind of welcome that he received. And she said he never spoke about it with her when he was in Vienna. But and then I saw that there is a calendar in 1979 that was produced by Air India on the theme of Ganjifa cards, and it says 1979 photograph and concept by Rudolf von Leyden.
Oh, lovely. But this this also this book also made me think about how great, I don't know, great, archiving is so important, right? And most of us, I mean, even the companies, very few companies like the Tatas and Times of India itself have excellent archives, but everybody, most other Indian entities are kind of like they're very sort of not very into archiving so much. And your whole book has been enriched, I thought, by the archives, right? By your
Right.
access to archives, good archives. So talk about that.
Right. So I think there is a growing awareness to acknowledge our histories. I think it's also a function of how we were growing as a nation, right? Where there were so many other aspects to put in place that archiving was not, one of the priorities for companies. The focus is always on growth, but to acknowledge your history and the impact that it has made. That's the story. I think now many of these corporate companies are also understanding that this is, again, my understanding of the situation, where there is the if you have an if you have to tell your story, you have to acknowledge your history, and therefore you have to find your history, and create a certain storytelling around it. And it's not just, I think Godrej also, they great archive has great archive, but even it's like a gallery like Kemmel, right, which is for 60 years, to have them have a professional a company come and not create but give a certain semblance to their archives is I think it hugely sort of impacted my research, and I'm sure it will impact and help other researchers as well. So I think there is a growing awareness.
Yes. Like the Times of India archives, I'm sure like there's so much in there because they're like really detailed and they've been kept for like donkey's years from what I remember. So, I'm sure a lot of other people can write, I mean, base their books like how like it struck you. I'm hoping that it'll strike many more people also,
Surely, but I don't see, given that there is a growing awareness, it's not the priority because it does cost a certain amount of money to preserve these archives, to look after these archives, to digitize documents. And it's great that companies are sort of understanding that.
It's
Also,
important.
how do you view history, right? You always view history in hindsight when you're living in the present and doing like going through the motions in the present. You don't think of it as this is one day going to be historical, or this is going to, or if I write a paper, if I write an article today in a newspaper or a magazine, that this is going to be one day archival material for someone's research. But it's always in the hindsight that you see what you have and how much you value. Like for instance, the Leidens, right? When I went over to meet with them, it's just something that I've seen in families in Europe. They just keep everything, and that became archival material for me that informed the bulk of this research.
Yeah, so I would say that's like a very big difference between us and the Europeans. I mean, I'm not even talking about Americans because they're like relatively new to the world, right? But as ancient peoples, I mean, I don't know about the Chinese, maybe they are more into archiving, but certainly it's something that we need to sort of cultivate, perhaps, even within
And letter,
family.
that was the
Letters,
means of communication at that time. It's interesting what can be found in these letters also.
So, and all the and you've included so many letters, and those letters are so telling of the World War II, or what these people were going through, what even
I mean,
part Jewish people.
to receive a letter in 1945 after the war is over of the first letter that the daughter wrote, and you've gone by 5 years of zero communication. Imagine going 5 hours without communication from your loved one, and you'll wonder if they are okay. Because to go about 5 years knowing that nothing, terrible could have happened to them. I mean, and she says this letter makes me feel like I know your world and what you've been through, and I thought it was quite telling. Also kind of gives you a glimpse into their life and the construct of society at that time. The fact, these diary notes, for instance, where she scribbled about Bombay, complained about Bombay, the mother, the main one. You understand how Bombay was at that time. You understand, I got a sense of their privilege. In the war years, when the rest of the country and city were rationing food, they were enjoying the best caviars and oysters at some cocktail party at Malabar Hill. So you realize that they were pretty much integrated with that fantastic part of Bombay that was not quite affected by what was going around everything. They very much lived the privileged life in Bombay.
Yeah, but to her credit, she understood that as well, because she said that, she mentions the westernized Bombay, and she mentions, that they were privileged. A lot of,
Yes,
I'm sure a lot of people,
they integrated with the expat community, right? The only Indian to be featured in her letter is their house help Narayan. Unlike her sons, who really like, and she's who kind of took the artistic community, they took the artistic community under their wings. And what I appreciated about them, that there was no patronizing attitude.
That's true.
But that's something that I think moved me.
And also there's this point where von Leyden himself says that, you move in, I was very much the Saab, and then later it's where
Begin when
friendships
then add
begin.
in when the Sahib disappears.
So that was a really telling thing about how Europeans were viewed at that point, right, in a newly independent India. So, and those sort of insights kind of give the reader an idea of what people were like then as well, Indians themselves. And this fantastic, now that this Palestine thing is going on, and bombing and all that. This bit where Nehru says that the Jews can have a homeland here, they can come and live here. I was like, wow, did he even suggest that? Some of them, the
One who had visited Bombay in Flora, she has done a fair amount of research in this particular area, and there was a bit for select migration. But yeah, I guess it was also it was a different time, right? Because we were a British Bombay, right? And Germany was at war with England, and so that meant that life in the British Bombay is going to be safe. And there were, but I do understand from, I spoke with Dr. Anil Bhatti, a scholar who has done research in this area, and with the Flora Fight Wild, who Rudy's niece, who's also done research in this particular area. And there was a bid for Select Migration. Yeah. And they
Yeah.
were largely, they were quite open.
What
Yeah.
an it made me think of how history could have been different if that actually happened. If there was select migrations like that. It's just a thought. And I was wondering why Gandhi was so anti it. I mean, you mentioned that as well. I wonder why. I mean, one doesn't know. I suppose one will have to do more research to find out why he wasn't for the idea. But these sort of things, I thought your book was like very rich in detail like that,
Thank you. Thank you. I mean,
So
like, Agar, for me, to my mind, it was always not an art book. Like, it was about an art person, a pivotal art person. It was never about that his life is going to be viewed in isolation. It had to be contextualized in the time that he lived in an era that he lived in. And in the circles that he roamed, the Bombay that he came to know as home, the home that was Germany, and the home that he made after he left India in Vienna. So all of this was really important to me to not, and therefore, like I said, I approached it as a social history book, and I was very, very grateful to my editor who completely understood what I was doing with the book, writing, and in the kind of that process also was the, like, research was one part of the challenge. The second part was writing this book. And I feel like, I don't know if other writers go through this, but I went through a lot of like internal struggle within myself, in terms of making sure that this book is not just for your primary audience, which is your curators, researchers, art students, art collectors, art gallerists, art consultants, auction houses. That would be my primary readership. But beyond that, how do I have them get excited about this story? Was something that I was quite keen to do with the book, and I hope I've managed to achieve it to a degree.
Yeah, you have, because otherwise, generally art books, I mean the typical art books, I mean I'm not saying this is one, are very ponderous to read often, So what you've done, I mean maybe it's your journalistic background as well. You've made it very readable but packed with information. So it's not frivolous, but I mean it's a serious work, but it's not a mountain to climb, in terms of jargon and stuff like that, which is often the case with bad writing. Often, even if it's like very full of like verbiage, the right terms. Often, this is a failing with a lot of art writing, which I don't find in this, which is why I found it so enjoyable. So you want to talk
I mean,
about
that is, in the community, it's also quite debatable. But I feel like, with due respect to the academic style of writing and the journalistic style of writing, I feel like what I wanted to do was tell a story and eventually tell a story on how I want to tell it. Tell it in sort of like how I would tell you a story about how I'd like to hear a story. I feel once I kind of like got over that how this book should be written, how this book should be perceived, how this book will be sort of received, I decided to just sit there, brush the thought aside, and write the manuscript. But I must tell you, the process of the editing also was quite I wouldn't call it an uphill task, but it was a learning curve, and I feel like I came out so much more enriched at the end of the journey. I remember, so the editor of the book is Mehru Gokhale, and she I remember when I, she was the first one actually to read the book cover to cover. And somewhere I was also hiding the manuscript for a while because I was like, I don't know how this is going to be perceived because I don't know, it's not written in an art writing fashion. And you know, you're kind of like fighting your own self and your own insecurities. And she read it. And she, of course, week after week sent me her development edits and we went through the process. And then I was scheduled for a Zoom call with her. And I had this list of 25 questions. And she read this book and she came on the call for precisely 5 minutes. And she said, did you go through the edits? And I said, yes, I did. And I have all these questions. She said, when you start working on the edits and see which you want to, you know, kind of work, you know, which you want to kind of use in your, how you want to
Incorporate.
shape your manuscript, incorporate, right? I was kind of not, that word wasn't coming to me somehow. Incorporate in your work. Those kind of questions will be addressed, but that's not my problem with the manuscript. And I kind of panicked internally because I was like, there's a problem with the manuscript. And she's like, the research is all there, the work is all there. My main problem with the manuscript is that there is too much second guessing. It is almost like you're questioning yourself, why are you writing this book? And how are you writing this? And I thought that I'm like, how do you like it? It felt like as if she called me out. Right. And I sort of confessed to her that there are two problems. One is that I didn't live in that era. I have never met this man. So there's this constant at the back of my mind wondering, why am I writing this book? Why someone who knew him, even as a child, has met him, who knew the Bombay of that time, writing this book? And so she was like, well, because they are not writing this book, you are writing this book. You have research, solid research. And let me remind you, an author writes with a sense of authority. If you don't own your research, you don't own your voice, no reader is going to connect with this manuscript. And this I can tell you with my experience. And so she
Okay.
gave me a week off to keep that manuscript aside and told me to rewrite the draft.
Oh.
And that is when I had the big picture. Right, like it was like a painting. She gave me the metaphor of the painting. Let's understand what the painting is, then focus on the little brush strokes.
Okay.
And that's, I think, a lot of that feedback kind of enriched my journey, right, into this process of writing.
Okay.
And
Okay.
I think that's something that's one of the great, I mean, the most important feedback I came away with, that in order to truly, you have to come to, it's an internal process, you know, where you have to come to terms with owning your voice and believing in it. And it's truly like, if you don't, and that's true of any creativity, right? It's true for a painter, it's true for a musician, it's true for a filmmaker. And that internal journey was, I think, it that it was it was it like I said, I came away quite enriched. I
Okay,
mean, it
great.
to me it was like, how will I do this? But I think once you kind of like understand what that meant, you kind of like rework it in a way that you feel it really. At that point, it became, you know what? I'm just going to tell the story the way I want to hear a story.
Good, because that's what I mean, you owned it, so that's good.
Thank
So are you working
you.
on anything now, or are you giving yourself a break, or what?
Oh, well, I mean, now I can speak about it. So I've come on board as the editor at Art India. It's
Okay.
India's longest running art magazine. And again, I wouldn't call it challenge, but the task at hand is to, how do you stay abreast, reinvent, and you know, be relevant in this relentless digital age, right?
Yes,
Where
yes.
everyone vying for that validation on, you know, like they say, you know, we are in the era of the gram, right? So whether it is food, whether it is fashion, whether it's art, everyone is vying for that. Your attention span is just a scroll away. Your validation is about that like. And
Yes.
that's the function of how we're consuming information, right? How does then, so the idea is, how do you reimagine something that has such a rich legacy and still coexist in this digital era? So that I think is a deeply challenging yet fulfilling task at hand that I'm currently working. And the first edition should be out in the first week of June. So, and again, the my primary mandate has always been about innovate it, make it accessible, and make it, like, of course, inclusive. But I think accessibility is something that, how do I make this world exciting to people who are not just art people? That is something that I have. It's something I followed through in my mirror days. I started off at HT actually, then at Mirror. And when I was this young rookie reporter writing about arts and culture, I used to always feel quite intimidated going to these galleries. I was what, 19, 20. I started writing when I was in college. And I used to always think to myself at that age, I'll never be able to write like this. And it was when I went to the UK to complete my master's, and the focus was in on arts journalism. And I had access to Guardian, Telegraph, The Times in their libraries. And my dissertation was on the changing nature of British quality press, tracing certain periods. I realized that how this world of arts and culture has come alive for me through these writings. And engaged me in such a deeper, in such a accessible and fun manner that why can't something that inspires and draws me towards it, why can't I make it exciting to people who are not, like I said, art people, right? And that's when I realized, and the mandate at Mirror was very clear: as long as I'm able to breathe a city or a news angle to the to what I'm pitching, I got to write Sunday essays, Sunday profiles, Sunday features that went up to 1,500, 2,000 words. And suddenly, like I had friends like, who are these people you're writing about? Why can't you write about Ranbir Kapoor?
Oh my
Why can't
God.
So I took that as a challenge. I was like, how do I make this person excited about, I'm not saying, artist versus a film star that's a different audience, but how do I make the world of art exciting to people who are not drawn to it? And I feel like, irrespective of background, circumstance, everyone should be able to achieve, be able to engage with art. And good
That's
art,
true.
bad art, it's all relative, right? But that engagement should not stop because of a certain gatekeeping in writing.
Yes, that's true.
And that's what I felt as a 19-year-old when I entered these galleries. It was like, and see, when you're 19, 20, you're always questioning yourself. Like, am I not intelligent enough? Do I not understand? Am I able to do that? But then I realized that, okay, I want to engage with it, but I also am quite aware of the fact that I cannot engage with it in this manner. So how do I engage it with in the manner that I want to engage with? And how do I make this world exciting to people who keep asking me, what am I doing? What am I, people you're writing about? And I'm like, this is interesting. I mean, I would give that weight as well, I wouldn't dismiss it that, oh, you're silly and you don't understand all this, because these are friends who are well read, well versed, well traveled, and they know what they're talking, and they'd never understood what I was, what are these places I go to, what are these people I meet. And then I was like, okay, why am I always at the museum? They don't understand me. So I was like, okay, let's make this world exciting to them.
Okay,
So
so
I
that's
think that it's always been in my subconscious, and that's something that came across in my book. And that came across as in, I mean, and I guess it's something that, like I said, make this world exciting and accessible to as many people so that they don't question you, who are these people you're writing about? Why can't you write about Ranbir?
So on that note, we'll end. For the listeners, go out and get The Catalyst, Rudolf von Leyden, and India's Artistic Awakening by Rima Desai-Gehi. It's an excellent book. Excellent book, Rima. I loved reading it, and there's so much information, but it's very readable and it's enlightening. And it gave me a picture of
Thank you.
Bombay that was really wonderful. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HD Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.hdsmartcast.com.
Hey, I'm Ruben. My band and I have a new song. I'm also a tow truck driver. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I get to go home at the end of the day and see my bandmates.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.